Welcome to the Employment Law and HR Podcast with your host, Allison Cauley.
Hello and welcome to episode number 28 of the Employment Law and HR Podcast. I'm your host, Allison Cauley. Thank you very much for tuning in and listening to this podcast. For those of you who are regular listeners, thank you so much for being a regular listener. For those of you who have just found me, again, thanks very much. I really appreciate you listening in. The purpose of this podcast is to provide updates on employment law and HR best practice for employers, managers, HR professionals, and anyone really who's interested in employment law. For the past year, this podcast has been running and it has been on a fortnightly basis, most of the time every other week. But due to challenges of work, there have been some times when it's been a little late or I've missed an episode. So I'm sorry about that. But moving forward, I have got a new format for the show and it will be coming to you on a weekly basis. Every Friday, there will be a new podcast and 1 week it will be in the normal format like this one today, with me just talking to you and telling you about an update in the law, a case, or just giving you a summary of a question or something that's been asked and my best practice HR tip. And then the following week will be an interview. So it will be an interview with somebody who works in HR or who has something interesting to say that I think you would like to hear. So for employers and business owners, managers, etc. That's how it's going to be going forward. So hopefully you'll find the new format really useful for you. And as always, I will welcome feedback from anybody about what you'd like in the podcast, what you don't like about the podcast. And also if you'd like to be interviewed, if you think you've got something to say or something of value for the listeners, then do get in touch. You can email me. It's Alison@realemploymentlawadvice.co.uk. And I'd be happy to set that up for you. So without further ado, I'm going to get into this week's featured content. Now, this week's featured episode comes about as a result of an email I received from a listener. So thank you very much. He asked if we could cover settlement agreements in the podcast. And so that's what I'm going to do today. And I realise I haven't actually touched on settlement agreements in the podcast before. Today, what I'm going to give you is just a brief overview about what a settlement agreement is, when you should use it, and some of the legal requirements of settlement agreements. So what is a settlement agreement? Well, settlement agreements are a way of resolving disputes with employees. So where a legal dispute may have arisen, it's a way of dealing with that without having to go to an employment tribunal, or where there might be the potential for an issue to arise, so a potential claim. It's a way, again, of dealing with that. And it gives everybody a clean break. Now, what normally happens with a settlement agreement, the employee agrees to waive most of their employment rights. There's some that they can't, which I'll come on to. And in return, the employer pays them a sum of money as compensation for those rights. And usually what happens is the employee's employment will terminate, and that will be dealt with in the settlement agreement as well. Now, a settlement agreement doesn't necessarily have to result in the termination of employment. It can be used to waive those rights that have accrued to that date. So let's just say there's a dispute about pay, for instance, and the employee alleges that they've got a claim for breach of contract, and you decide that you want to reach an agreement with them to settle that. So you pay them a sum of money, you get them to sign an agreement to say that they can't pursue that right any further, and their employment would continue. What happens in that situation is the settlement agreement only waives their rights up until the date that they sign, and thereafter anything else they accrue would potentially result in other claims in the future. So that's to say, contrary to popular belief, a settlement agreement doesn't have to result in the termination of employment. However, my experience is such that it normally does. Once you get to the point of a settlement agreement, relations have broken down normally, or the employee wants to leave or the employer wants them to leave. So termination is normally an inevitable factor in settlement agreements. Now, what I'm not going to do today is go into any depth about how you reach the point of a settlement agreement with your staff. This is something known as a protected conversation or a without prejudice discussion with employees that leads into the settlement agreement. And I'll cover that in another episode of the podcast. But what I would say today is that if you intend to propose a settlement agreement to your employees, you should ensure that you are covered by the regulations in relation to protected conversations, and or that your correspondence and discussions are on a without prejudice basis, to ensure that the employee then can't refer to those discussions later on if a settlement agreement isn't reached. So normally the process is either the employer will propose the settlement agreement, or the employee, quite often nowadays, and certainly when I'm advising employees, I suggest that initially they try to resolve matters without the need to go straight to the employment tribunal, and therefore employees can approach employers on a without prejudice basis and make an offer. And then if an agreement is reached, it's put into the format of a settlement agreement. Now, a settlement agreement must be set out in a particular way in order to be legally binding. And the reason for this is that the law recognises that in most cases, employees are in a weaker bargaining position than employers, and it's to prevent employers taking advantage of employees by getting them to sign any old document to say that they waive their rights. Settlement agreements must be in a certain format in order to be legally binding, and if it doesn't meet the requirements, then it wouldn't be enforceable, and therefore the employee could potentially still pursue their employment rights or a potential claim in the employment tribunal even after signing a settlement agreement which isn't valid. What does it need to include? So the legal requirements for a settlement agreement are as follows. It must be in writing, so it must be written. It must relate to a particular complaint or particular proceedings. So there must be reference in there to the particular issue or complaint that they have. So let's just say you have an employee who has a potential complaint for discrimination and it's relating to maternity, for instance. So they've got some rights, maternity rights, and a claim for discrimination. You must ensure that that is the particular claim that's listed in the agreement. Now, what is standard practice, I have to say, is for particular complaints to be identified, and then for a further clause which lists every possible potential claim that an employee might have to ensure that all of those claims are waived as well. And that is standard practice. It's normally in the form of a schedule at the end. It's normally about a 3-page document with all of the potential claims listed. But it need not be. As long as the agreement relates to the particular complaint or particular proceedings, then it would be legally binding. The third thing that must be covered with the settlement agreement is that an employee must have received legal advice from a relevant independent advisor about the terms of the settlement agreement. Now, independent legal advisors are also defined, and there are broadly four types of independent advisors. There's qualified lawyers or solicitors, there are trade union officials, and in some circumstances there are a voluntary sector. So in some organisations, some law centres, etc., people have been certified as competent to give advice on settlement agreements, so they can be an advisor. And finally, there are others. So that's people like legal executives who are fellows of the Institute of Legal Executive. They can also sign a settlement agreement if they're employed by a solicitor's practice. Normally, it will be a qualified solicitor who advises them, but it could be one of those four. And in order to be legally binding, as I said, the employee must have had some legal advice in advance. The advisor must have a contract of insurance or professional indemnity insurance, so that's covering the risk of a claim by the employee. With regards to solicitors, certainly, they will have a form of insurance, professional indemnity insurance, in order to meet with their own regulations anyway. So as a solicitor, I have to have a certain level of professional indemnity insurance in order to practice. And so there would be something in the settlement agreement which just confirms that. The agreement must also identify the advisor. You'd think it's obvious, but that's one of the requirements. And the agreement must state that the conditions regulating settlement agreements have been satisfied. So there are a number of statutory provisions regarding settlement agreements, and the normal practice is within the settlement agreement to have a clause which says that this agreement complies with the following regulations and then has a long list of them. And again, as I say, that's fairly standard practice across the board, and that's the best way of doing it, to be honest. There are certain claims that cannot be compromised by means of a settlement agreement. And they are, again, normally listed in the settlement agreement as being accrued pension rights. So an employee will retain their pension rights and claims for personal injury or future personal injury. And what I would normally advise, it says, is that claims for personal injury which are not known to the employee at the date of signing the settlement agreement are not waived. So it still covers those things that they might not know about now or that might manifest themselves later in life, and also in relation to any personal injury that could come up in the future. There are various other rights that may not be settled by a settlement agreement, so rights that can't be waived. I don't propose to list them on the podcast, but I will put them in the show notes, which you can find at adviceforemployers.co.uk/podcast/28. Now, when it comes to preparing the settlement agreement, regardless of who has proposed the settlement in the first place, it's normally the responsibility of the employer to prepare the settlement agreement terms. And what I would say is I strongly advise that you as the employer provide the terms, that you don't leave it for the employee to do. I have acted on a couple of occasions for employees who have been told by their employer that they have to get a solicitor to prepare the settlement agreement. Now, when acting on behalf of the employee, it's not in the employee's best interest to cover off all of the potential issues in a settlement agreement that an employer might like to. So normally what happens is settlement agreements cover more than just the legal minimum in order to provide the employer with additional protection to cover scenarios that could arise. And so if, as you're asking your employee to prepare it, it would be in their best interest to keep the settlement agreement as simple as possible and just cover off the minimum legal requirements. So that's why I say it's always recommended that the employer or the employer's representative prepare the settlement agreement. As I said, aside from the legal requirements for a settlement agreement, employers normally want to include other things in there. For instance, it's advisable to include a clause regarding confidential information to ensure that the employee's obligations in relation to confidentiality continue. If they have something like a restriction on a post-termination restriction in their employment contract that say prevents them from soliciting your customers, it would be advisable to restate that within the settlement agreement to make it completely clear to the employee that they are still bound by those restrictions. And then normally what happens is you would have a clause in there about the confidentiality of the settlement agreement. Now, obviously, there are some circumstances where an employee will be required to disclose the fact that they've had a settlement agreement. Say, for instance, to HMRC, or if they're making a benefit claim, or they might want to just talk about it to their family or their spouse. So normally you would have an exemption there, but what you don't want to be doing is allowing your employees who have had a settlement agreement to talk about it to other staff members. If it becomes known that it is standard practice to settle claims, employees can sometimes exploit that and take advantage of the fact that they know that you will settle. So I would always recommend that you ensure that any discussions are confidential and that there's a confidentiality clause in the agreement regarding the agreement itself. There are various other clauses that you should include within the settlement agreement, including repayment of the compensation that you give if the employee breaches the agreement, and some various other things, but I don't propose to go into those in this podcast. What I would say to you is that if you are providing your staff with a settlement agreement, it is well worth investing in getting some advice on that. The best thing to do is to get a solicitor to draft it for you to make sure that you're covered. If you're using an old template, I would suggest that if it's older than 6 months, that you should get that updated and certainly get some advice on it. Because what's the point in paying out money to your staff to waive their claims if you're not entirely covered by the terms of the agreement that you're offering? Settlement agreements is certainly something that I can help with. It's normally a fairly straightforward matter, and therefore if you want to get in touch, I can deal with that for you. You can contact me via the website, which is adviceforemployers.co.uk, or by email. It's alison@realemploymentlawadvice.co.uk. Now for my HR best practice tip of the week. And this one follows on from a case which I reported in my newsletter last week. So for those of you who don't know, I also produce a fortnightly newsletter for anyone who signs up online. And in that, I send out updates on various cases that I don't necessarily cover in this podcast. But in the last newsletter last week, I covered a case which involved Facebook. And it just reminded me of the importance of including a social media policy in your handbook. And I would strongly recommend nowadays that you have a social media clause within your employee contracts. The reason for this is that it makes it completely explicit to the employees what your expectations of them are. And therefore, if they were to breach those expectations, you would have cause for disciplinary and potentially dismissal. When it comes to analysing the reasonableness of a decision, particularly a decision around the use of social media and personal time, having that clause in the contract will be crucial. So what I've done is in the blog, which you can find at adviceforemployers.co.uk/blog, and have a look, scroll down to the Facebook case, I've included some information there about the case itself, but also reference to a clause I would recommend you at least include in your employee contracts. And what I'll do is I'll put a note in the show notes, which you can find at adviceforemployers.co.uk/podcast/28, and I'll include the clause that I would recommend that you use or you use as a basis for a clause in your employment contracts, just to cover off those situations where your reputation may be at stake when it comes to your employees' use of social media. So my HR best practice tip of the week is get your social media in order, make sure you have a policy in place, and also consider putting a clause into your standard employment contracts to cover your reputation. So that's it. I've reached the end of this week's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. As I said at the beginning of the show, the podcast will be changing and I will be coming to you weekly from now on. And this has partly been a decision I've made as a result of the fact that the podcast has been going for a year, but it's also I've been spurred on to bring it to you on a weekly basis by the fact that I have reached the final four of the best podcast in the UK at the UK Podcasters Awards. So I'm really excited and thank you so much to everyone who has voted. You can continue to vote for me to win that award. You can only vote once between now and the end of August 2015. But if you go on and vote, then I would be very grateful. And of course, please drop me a note to say that you voted and I'd be happy to mention you in the podcast. So you can vote via New Media Europe website and look for the podcast awards, or you can go onto the website and I'll put a link in the show notes for where you can vote. So once again, thank you very much for listening. I do really appreciate your support and thank you to those people who have contacted me with their comments, and hopefully you've enjoyed this podcast. Have a great week. Thanks again for listening. Just want to finalise by saying I wouldn't be a lawyer unless I had a legal disclaimer. So I must just say to you that the information in this podcast is for information only. It's a general review and a general update. It's always necessary to get specific legal advice about your circumstances. So please don't rely on anything that you've heard in this podcast. But please do feel free to contact me if you'd like further information or specific advice.